Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Jason Snell.
Hi, John.
Listeners to The Incomparable need no introduction, but why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself anyway?
Sure. So I run The Incomparable Network, which this podcast is on, and do a podcast, the Mothership Incomparable Podcast. And in another life, I am also a technology journalist and podcaster at sixcolors.com and Relay FM. And I am excited to be back here for, I don't know, like the fifth time. And once again, we've managed to find a work of literature that I actually read as an assignment in high school, which is very exciting for me.
This time we are doing A Perfect Day for Banana Fish by J.D. Salinger, originally published in The New Yorker way back in 1948. So tell me what your history is with this story.
I don't know which grade. I'm going to guess this was, believe it or not, I think this was in Mr. Duggan's sophomore English class at Sonora High School in 1986 that we read this. I remember it being, I think we were given like a photocopy, right? Like a stapled together photocopied sheet that was handed out to the class, you know, as a reader of short stories. We were probably being encouraged as part of that class to probably write a short story of our own, something like that. But my recollection, I know I read it for sure. It's possible that it was in my junior year, but I absolutely remember sitting in the humanities building at Sonora High School in Sonora, California, and reading a tale of the East Coast, a tale of New Yorkers in Miami that was entirely foreign to me as a Californian. But yeah, my guess is sophomore year also, because I think that's when we read Catcher in the Rye. So it wouldn't surprise me if all the Salinger came then.
This is the first time I've actually read this story, although I've heard its title quite often. As I was saying to you earlier, there's a very funny joke in BoJack Horseman that only makes sense if you know this title. and I leave it to the listeners to find that joke. You'll know it when you see it. But I was talking to my wife earlier in the evening, and I was saying, when I was growing up in the 1970s, I was hanging out, you know, in my parents' house, and my parents are academics. They would hang out with academics. It seemed like every home I went to had a copy of Nine Stories by J.D. Salinger. Mm. I remember that cover of that paperback. They had that, and they had Franny and Zoe, which is his other compilation of two stories. And I was saying there must have been something about Salinger and that generation. That my parents are technically the silent generation. They're right before the boom, but it seems like
mine too.
Every boomer out there had this book. You know, they also had a copy, I don't know why, of Under Milkwood. I don't know if that's your experience, but this is my experience. Probably because I grew up amongst a bunch of liberal elites, I guess.
I was going to say, you were in the Midwest, but in a college town. I grew up in a place where, I mean, most of my friends were the kids of the professional people in the town, but you could count us on two hands, probably the you know, the reporter's kid and the doctor's kid and the priest's kid and the, like you and the dentist kid and the orthodontist kid. I was the orthodontist kid. I mean, that's just sort of how it was. So no, we don't have that. Although I have always felt like Salinger in particular, and as I've grown up and learned more over the years, it does feel very much like this is the fact that he was in the New Yorker, the fact that the kinds of subjects that he often wrote about, it always feels super Eastern elite, kind of like that is the world that he was writing about, at least to a certain degree, and was appreciated by, right, being all those pieces in the New Yorker, which apparently, according to what I read about this story, this is the story that bonded him to the New Yorker, where apparently after this, he was like, everything I write, it's going in the New Yorker, which is also kind of interesting.
Yeah, this was the story that kind of made J.D. Salinger. Apparently, I did my reading of Wikipedia as well.
Yep. Classic. Everybody else can check it out. It's the IMDb trivia of literature podcasts.
You know, he published apparently on and off, but it wasn't until this story came along. And this story was something of a sensation. They mentioned that the editors of the New Yorker liked the writing style. They liked the dialogue, but they found the story absolutely inscrutable. Like, mm-hmm. they couldn't figure out what the heck the story was supposed to be about. So they apparently, Salinger worked with them and changed the story. I don't know how much he changed, because it is still a very obtuse
right.
story.
It sounds like what they did, and we can talk about, I mean, it's a 4,000 word story, so get a podcast out of it any way we can. But it sounds like what the editorial feedback to him was essentially take one step back in the story. Basically, like, give us a little bit of context for what we're seeing with the main character, who is Seymour Glass, who the thing that stuck with me through the 40 years since I read this story, is the little girl saying, Seymour Glass. But anyway, he's part of the Glass family, which ended up being used in all sorts of different works by Salinger. And their feedback was basically like, who is this guy? Give us a little more context about what happens. And so there's one, you know, this essentially two or two and a half scene short story, two scene short story gets an extra scene that puts, without seeing him, puts him in context. So, you know, who he is a little bit, right? You're right. It's still 4,000 words. It's still oblique, but I get it. It's just like, it's just seeing his wife in the hotel room on the phone to her mother. Like, oh, okay. Like, it's just enough, I think. So that's, I thought, a pretty good note.
No, it was good. It was a good note. This story opens with Seymour's wife talking on the phone to her mom. So we get all these things enumerated for us, that this is a couple. They're from the Northeast, they're coming down here to Florida, and the wife is making reference to problems that Seymour is having. Apparently, anger management problems, a problem perhaps crashing a car. Everything is dealt with very obliquely, and I admire this about Salinger, because writing exposition is hard. And he somehow gets through it in a way that seems more natural than it ought to be, given the amount of information that gets dumped in this one phone call.
Yeah, Salinger, nobody out there needs to be told, I suppose. Like, alert everybody, it's 2024, alert everybody. J.D. Salinger, in addition to being a recluse, was a really great writer. He's just a great writer. And I was struck again. I have not read a lot of his stuff. And I remember reading Catcher in the Rye and thinking, oh, you know, this, he's really good. And this is, I think, so well written and well drawn, and all the details are interesting. And I love the details of it's Muriel, right, on the phone with her mother. And the fact that what's clear is her mother fears for her daughter, because something's wrong with her daughter's husband. And then, yeah, the implication is that he, you didn't let him drive, did you? I'm worried he's going to do something like that. Like that time, it's implied the time he tried to run off the road and into a tree and maybe kill himself. It starts out reading, at least I started out reading it as worried about him being violent to her, but it becomes sort of, as it resolves, it's more like she might be hurt in his impulse to hurt himself. And then we get that additional piece of information that he was in the war. And to me, that's what you need to carry. The details are interesting, but that's what you need to carry into the next scene, is that Seymour Glass is a deeply, deeply troubled man who came back from war and is World War II and is broken. And nobody is trying to fix him, apparently. Just let's send him off to Miami. He'll be fine. And his wife is sitting in the hotel room, you know, smoking cigarettes, doing her nails, waiting for a phone call to her mom, and reading women's magazines, while her husband, who is troubled, is just out on the beach, I guess, befriending the local children.
I guess the implication is this is a sort of a resort that has a limited number of people here.
Right.
They've kind of gotten to know each other over the course of a few days. We don't know how long he's been down here, but she says that he's out playing the piano every night.
Right.
He's we later, when Seymour talks to Sybil, the young girl he befriends, she obviously has met him before because she's saying his name over and over mm-hmm. again. And she's apparently jealous of the fact that another little girl has sat beside him on the piano bench.
Right.
So it reminds me of sort of like a rest cure sort of idea. Muriel doesn't seem particularly concerned. She's presented as kind of self-absorbed. Mm-hmm. You know, she's doing her nails as this opens, and she's going to read her what sounds like a Cosmopolitan magazine, although mm-hmm. Cosmopolitan, as we know it, didn't exist at this point. This is 48. This is 3 years after the war. It is a story about a guy who saw some stuff. And
yeah.
I don't think people had a very strong understanding of the psychology of this. After World War I, there was the term shell shock that was used. And then after World War II, they talked about battle fatigue. Today, we call it post-traumatic stress disorder, but mm-hmm. something about the way of just calling it battle fatigue seems like it's like nothing. It's like saying, oh yeah, he's tired, let him go off and rest. Salinger is dealing with stuff that I don't even know that he himself has the vocabulary to talk about, you know, because Muriel on the phone mentions that there's a psychiatrist in the hotel. She seems very dismissive of she said he talked to her like nothing came of it. This is also not that long after psychoanalysis is even a thing. It doesn't get to America till probably the late 30s. So here it is. It's like, so I don't know that Salinger knew what he was talking about in a way, but in another sense, I think he had a very great intuitive sense about what he was talking about.
Well, yeah, and the story, the banana fish, I mean, the story that he tells Sybil is about these, which he's, you know, making up as he goes to tell us, to weave a tale, spin a tale for this little girl that he's chatting with on the beach is, and it's sweet, you know, but he does say, there are these fish, they're banana fish, it's a perfect day to see them, and what happens is they lead a tragic life. They swim into a hole where there's a lot of bananas and they eat too many bananas. So they can't get out of the hole and they die and they can't help it. They just, it's terrible and they die. And, I mean, of all the stories to tell the little girl, and he says, I hate to tell you, but they die. But like, this is the point where my English teacher would say, understand. It's like these fish are doomed. They go here and they're unable to get out and they're trapped and it is, you know, fundamentally this hopeless, self-defeating, self-destructive, impossible to resist urge of the fish. And I don't know. I mean, this is one of those classic stories also, in just in the sense that you're saying, what am I seeing here? Until the last line, at which point he returns to the hotel and is sort of acts weird and paranoid in the elevator and goes back in his room and kills himself. As his wife is sleeping in the other bed in the two bed hotel room, he just blows his brains out, and that's the end. And so you're left to rewind, and I think that's the intent, right? You're left to rewind and consider, were there any signs? I think that that's part of it. Is this, you know, as a suicide where it's like, we knew he was troubled, but he seemed fine that day, and then this happened, and then his conversation with the little girl, which will never be recounted to anybody, right? Because it's just nonsense with this little girl, where he seems to be, you know, pouring out his heart a little bit about being, you know, hopelessly trapped and ruined.
Let's talk a little bit about this conversation he has with Sybil on the beach, mm-hmm. because when I was reading it through, I was really, really uncomfortable. We have this middle-aged guy who is troubled, alone on a beach with this little girl.
Mm-hmm.
In one of the strangest, creepiest things, the narrator, who never comments on anything, says she's wearing a two-piece bathing suit, but one piece of that won't be necessary for the next 10 years.
Right.
J.D. Salinger, I know you're gone. You can't hear me. That line really creeped me out. So I guess she's, what, like 9 or 10 or something like that?
Maybe even younger.
At one point, he kisses her on the foot. He seems to be very concerned about feet. Actually, when he comes back to the hotel, he's very upset because he thinks someone's looking at his feet. Now, I know that I am coming to this from my perspective, where I am hardwired to look with some suspicion on interactions between adults and children, particularly interactions between adult men and little girls. I think, as I read it through, that Salinger's point is more that Seymour is able to relate to Sybil because he's able to be silly with her. He's able mm-hmm. to be fantastic with her. He's able to indulge in fantasy. He finds that conversation easy, and I think it's met innocently, but what did you think?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think it is, he's been broken, and he doesn't know how to live in the world, and that the only way he can interact with anyone, apparently, is with this little girl, and the little girl when he was playing the piano, and like, on a level of sort of fantastic and absurd things that he's able to say. Although he does point out that she was mean to the dog, which he does in a very nice way. Cause he says, you know, I'll tell you what Sharon Lipschutz doesn't do is poke at that little dog. And it's like, but in general, he's just, it's absurd. Everything she says, he has a counter for, which I think is sweet. She says, I like to chew candles, because she asks about wax, and he's like, who doesn't? And he just doesn't. So I think that this is a refuge for him. He is a sad, falling apart person who is completely broken, and that this is like literally the only way he can relate to anybody in the world, is sort of how I read it.
As you say, when you get to the end of the story and he takes his own life, it is one of those actions by an author that makes you want to then go back and try to put the pieces together.
Right.
You know, it's sort of the sixth sense approach of of writing, where you start to think, did the author play fair with me? Did the mm-hmm. author give me the clues that I needed? And I can see why, without that opening section with his wife on the phone, you would feel completely at sea, and perhaps not the death would seem random to you rather than some sort of a tragic ending.
Yeah, I also I have another question related. Is there's that moment where the wife says, you know, Seymour doesn't want people looking at his tattoo. And the mother says, did he get one in the army? And she says, no, mother. And I had that thought, which is like, is that implying perhaps that he was taken prisoner and put in a concentration camp? because it might be the kind of tattoo you don't get in the army. And that would be another thing on the pile of why is he so destroyed as a person.
That's a really good idea. I would grant that that could be something that...
it also might be not real and imagined, right? Like, that's the other... I don't know!
That's the thing is... The one thing I know about Salinger is he hated to explain anything. He refused to explain anything. And he didn't like writing that he felt was too laden with meaning, like obvious open meaning. He was a kind of an intuitive writer. Maybe he had a meaning in mind when he wrote this. Maybe not. Maybe this was something that he followed his guts. But because of that, the experience of reading this can be, I think, a little bit bewildering. And
sure,
that's, I think, entirely the point.
I will say that the his father was one of the first people in one of the concentration camps.
Mm.
And so it's possible, but it's, again, only speculation. Because, and I get it. I mean, not revealing your tricks, leaving it open to interpretation. You know, David Chase always gets asked what happens to Tony Soprano after the last frame of The Sopranos. And he's like, whatever you want, because the show's over, right? Like, that's the answer is, I'm not telling you, because there's no, ultimately, there's no answer in the text. And therefore, there's no answer. It's for you to decide. And I don't mind that. And it is kind of fun, right? It's only 4,000 words to go back through the 4,000 words when you're done and say, well, what do we know about Seymour? Why would he do this? But like I said, I think part of it is the intent of the author is, I think having, I've never had a close person to me commit suicide, but I have been around a lot of them, especially when I was in high school. Actually, we had a rash of them. And this comes up a lot, which is the rewinding through recent history, trying to see if you can understand why it happened. And I felt like reading the story, I actually felt that same effect, which is why did he do it? Was he acting strangely? The last person he talked to was this little girl. Let's look at that conversation. Can we glean any meaning from it? And I actually don't know if Salinger intends for us to try. And I don't suspect he intends for us to succeed, right? I think perhaps it's even the failure is part of the intent. I don't know.
You know, before reading this, I had, of course, read Catcher in the Rye. And when you read that book, Holden Caulfield is a terribly chatty narrator who is going to tell you everything that's going on through his mind. He's going to try to explain scenes and motivations as he sees them to the reader. Now, he is unreliable in that, one, he isn't always aware of his own motivations, and two, he doesn't always understand what other people are doing or why they're doing it, and he may project bad intent on them. But he's constantly going to be in your ear telling you what he thinks. This is a completely different story. This is not a first person story. This is a third person story. And other than that, the narrator has strange opinions about little girls' bathing suits, the narrator gives nothing. And the characters give almost nothing. so you're kind of left gasping for motivation here, I guess.
Yeah. I'll say the thing about the bathing suit, I read that as being a little cynical, and also, you know, whether you want to read it as how we dress little girls like they're grown up, but they're not. But I think ultimately the purpose it serves in the story is just to make it clear that she's not somebody, a girl who is of interest to him, or him interesting to her in any way like that. It's like, it's a decade before she'll even fill out. It's sort of there. It's like, no, this is a little girl. And yet you say, like, why put it that way? But I could argue that the counter is, why is she dressed in a two-piece bathing suit? She's just a little girl. But it's more, a little more oblique and a little more cynical than that, which is, yes, from our narrator who doesn't otherwise exude anything in this entire story.
Salinger doesn't want to just come out and say, oh, she's seven years old. You know, if you read a lot of old stories from the 50s, you'll be shocked at the way that people get introduced all the time. Like, he walked into the room with his full 6 feet 2 inches, the coal black hair, you know, they have to describe every little aspect of a character when they introduce him. You know, you can see that Salinger had an enormous effect on everyone who came after him. I can definitely see Raymond Carver in this story, and all of the big post-war American male authors like Philip Roth or John Updike, I can see in this. But, you know, on the other hand, Salinger is writing about the white male experience. The wife here is so unlikable in a way, and the mom is not really a character. And when I think back to Catcher in the Rye, you know, the main female characters were the prostitutes or Holden's younger sister, and again, an innocent in that case. The good female characters are the ones who are still children. You know, maybe I'm being unfair. I should not try to base my opinions on these two works alone. But there's a kind of, and I'll probably edit this all out when I don't know that I'm going to say something that makes any sense here. But there's a kind of a post-war poor me kind of writing that I associate very strongly with people like Updike and Roth, and that's a little bit focused on how hard it is to be a guy, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You seem skeptical.
No, I think it is absolutely expected that a white man in the mid-20th century is going to write about what is worrying for him, and it's about white men in the mid-20th century. And that just, like, the default chooses the default in a culture. That's not right. That's real dog bites man kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Although you mentioned the wife, and yeah, I mean, look, it's very easy to read this as that she brought her broken, potentially dangerous to himself husband on vacation because she wanted a vacation, and they have not been together for most of it. That the psychiatrist back home said he could be a danger, but that she's like, oh, there's a psychiatrist here. I talked to him at dinner. Well, I didn't really talk to him. His wife, and she goes off, his wife is awful, and I didn't like them. And it was too loud, so we really didn't say anything. And, like, that's her answer to her mother saying, you know, does this man need help? You could read it that way. I don't know. I think it's interesting that she's doing her own thing, and he's out there all alone. And they don't seem particularly connected, right? Like, that is not the case. She and he are disconnected from each other, and she's paying attention to she's doing the stuff. It's almost like she's robotic in a way, right? She's reading a woman's magazine, she's doing her nails, she's sitting smoking cigarettes looking out the window, and that's like all she's doing. But it's not, I would say she's not portrayed as having a whole lot of an inner life or inner turmoil of any sort, right? She's just kind of like hanging out in Biden time.
Well, they literally live in different worlds. And that certainly was the case in this era of American history socially, that men and women occupied different spheres. And if this is a story in some ways about, and it is about dealing with the trauma of war, she literally cannot know what he went through, and he isn't going to tell her. He can't tell her, and that's part of the tragedy of the whole story.
Yeah, they're disconnected. She's, well, like, in reading it from the start, her confidence that Seymour is going to be okay can be read as supporting her husband, but he's not okay. And he ends up killing himself. So she's either wrong or doesn't care. When we get to that point, but at first she's sort of defending him, but is she really defending him to her mother? She's insisting. I think bottom line is what she feels is that she doesn't feel threatened by Seymour. And that's all that, and that's the self-absorption, right? Like, as far as she is concerned, he's not a danger to her and she wants a vacation. And so here they are.
I have to admit that when I read this through the first time, I was a little disappointed with the ending. And the reason is, it feels like a lot of books since the late 19th century end in suicide, which was kind of a legitimate way to end your story. Like, if you have a character who has suffered defeat, who can see no way forward, that was kind of a go-to plot mm-hmm. point. I feel like today, hopefully, people are a little more cautious about approaching the subject, because I think, first of all, I think people are a little bit more aware of things like depression or things like trauma.
Mm-hmm.
If you have been around suicide in your life, you know how crushing and horrible that is for people, the survivors, and certainly must be crushing and horrible for the people who decide to take their own lives. But this kind of felt more like, oh, here's the end of the story.
Yeah.
You know, it's the end of Anna Karenina. She's going to throw herself under the train. Sorry to spoil
Spoilers
Anna Karenina.
Spoilers for Anna Karenina. Yeah, I mean, it's a cliche now. I mean, leaving aside for a moment the kind of the complexity of suicide and not making it right. It feels like an easy exit for a story, especially since it's a story and you're out and you're never going to, you know, this world doesn't continue, even though he did write more stories about the Glass family. That this is, it ends, you know, with a bang. I mean, but it is by today's standards. Yeah. You look at it and you're like, it's the laziest. There was a movie or a TV show or something that had this as the shocking ending, and I thought, boo, right? Like, it's like it's just it does feel lazy. And I think, in fact, in part because it was originally shocking and everybody did it to shock you, and now everybody rolls their eyes at that because it's a cliche plus everything else about it. I'd like to be charitable here, at least in the sense that I think that this is what the story is ultimately about, is Seymour being broken and not being able to interact with anybody, and that so when you get to that moment where he kills himself, you have to do the rewind and say, wait a second, why did that happen? And I feel like I want to give Salinger credit for creating that feeling in me that I think is a thing that happens in cases of suicide, where you start to sift through your own memories of the person, and did I know, and could I have seen, and can anybody really know that? And I think that there is an aspect of that, and the post-traumatic stress that, I mean, I think that's what the story is about. So I want to give him credit for that, but you're right. Ending with a suicide as your big twist in your story is not generally, yeah, it feels like an old fashioned, and now cliched thing to do.
Well, it's funny because on this podcast, one thing that happens often is people, myself and my guests, will often say, oh, when I was a teenager, I didn't get this book, or it just seemed like mm-hmm. an assignment to me. You know, now I read it and it affects me in some way. And I had kind of like the reverse experience with this story. I feel like if I had read it when I was a teenager, I would have liked it a lot, because I was really into sort of angsty, like, yeah, uh-huh. yeah, real stuff at the
That's
end.
That's why they assigned Salinger in high school.
Well, I did read Catcher in the Rye, and that one, as I recall, I had the experience of being a teenager who said, I don't understand this book. I don't understand why I have to follow this character who I don't like. Reading it again as an adult, I'm like, of course you don't like, he's a difficult character. That's why you love him, you know? So anyway, But yeah. You know, but because this is a podcast and I try to give everything a strong chance, I read this story through again, because you can read it through very, very quickly. And I think that as I read it more and more, I grew to like it more and more, because his dialogue is just so intoxicating to me.
Yeah, the dialogue between Seymour and the little girl, I mean, it does go, there are some action in it, but like, it's a dialogue. Like, that's what this story primarily is this one conversation between a sad man and a little girl who's at the beach and having a good time, and he's having a good time talking to her, really, and having this sort of fabulous kind of conversation. And it's so well done. Like, just the art of that and the craft of that, it's really beautifully depicted, I would say, which I think, you know, intended to contrast with what happens after. But that's what, when I say he's a hell of a writer, like, it just, it's easy to read, but there's complexity there, and his dialogue is really great.
Any last thoughts before we close the book on poor Seymour?
I would love to go up to J.D. Salinger's house and knock on his door and ask him all about it. But he died, so he's not there anymore. I'm sure he would have welcomed us both 15 years ago, but not now, alas.
Thanks again to guest host Jason Snell. If you have an idea for a book, story, poem, or other reading to cover on a future episode, or a suggestion for a guest host, or if you simply like to say hi, you can write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. I love to hear from listeners. The Sophomore Lit theme song is by Malcolm Nygaard. This podcast is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. More funny, smart podcasts are available at theincomparable.com. Okay, I think that'll be it.
All right, that's good.
I think we
perfect. It's a perfect.
It's a perfect day for a podcast.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.